A U.S. delegation wants one thing of Turkey.
We need them to stand down. We need a ceasefire.
One thing Turkey says it won't do. What's the Trump administration's strategy for stopping an invasion that it cleared the way for?
I'm Steve Inskeep with Noel King, and this is Up First from NPR News. Gordon Sondland is one of those self-proclaimed three amigos.
We've been tasked with sort of overseeing the Ukraine-U.S. relationship.
That allegedly involved pressuring Ukraine to investigate President Trump's political rival. What's known of a wealthy supporter of the president who became a diplomat?
And there is a new Brexit deal today. The European Union has announced that they've reached an agreement with the United Kingdom on Brexit. What is the likelihood that the British Parliament will approve it? Stick with us. We've got the news you need to start your day.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Guardian Insurance, helping nearly 27 million people look after what they love most, because everyone deserves a Guardian. Visit GuardianLife.com. Guardian is a registered trademark of the Guardian Life Insurance Company of America, New York, New York. Support also comes from ExxonMobil, the company that believes affordable, scalable carbon capture is critical to reducing industrial CO2 emissions. And more experts agree. Learn more at energyfactor.com.
Vice President Mike Pence is in Turkey today. He's trying to negotiate a ceasefire.
The vice president is traveling with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. They plan to meet with Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan after more than a week of attacks on Syrian Kurdish forces. Of course, the Turkish invasion began only after President Trump's decision to pull U.S. troops out of that part of Syria. Now the White House wants the Turkish military to stop. Here's what President Trump had to say about the Kurds, who were partners with U.S. forces for years in the fight against ISIS.
And I say, why are we protecting Syria's land? Assad's not a friend of ours. Why are we protecting their land? And Syria also has a relationship with the Kurds, who, by the way, are no angels.
President Trump has also threatened sanctions against Turkey, and he downplayed tensions yesterday.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson has been following all of this from here in Washington. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Noel.
So President Trump has sent Pence to Turkey to pursue a ceasefire. He's also threatened sanctions. Has he explained a coherent strategy here?
He hasn't explained a coherent strategy, but he has said, as you heard him before, that this is not our problem. He said he wants to get out of the Middle East. He has also echoed Erdogan's language and called some of the Kurds terrorists worse than ISIS. And so far, there has not been a big cost to Turkey. Pence and Pompeo want a ceasefire. It's unlikely that Erdogan would agree to that. He said he won't, certainly not until he has established more control over northern Syria. And we've learned that in his heart of hearts, Donald Trump is more Rand Paul than Lindsey Graham. He has isolationist instincts, and now he's acted on them.
Yesterday, the House voted to condemn the president's move. They voted overwhelmingly. Is there anything Congress can do at this point?
Well, that's a good question. The vote was huge, 354-60. And in the past, foreign policy is one area where Republicans have felt free to criticize the president and break with the president. There have been big votes on Russia sanctions, veto-proof majorities. There have been symbolic resolutions supporting NATO. And they are discussing sanctions that are tougher than the ones the president is talking about. But at least some members of Congress are also starting to think about the future. What, if anything, could Congress do proactively to make sure, for instance, if Trump is reelected, that he can't pull out of NATO with a tweet? Or what if he decides to pull U.S. troops off the Korean Peninsula with a tweet? It's not clear if Congress could do anything about that, but these are the things that are on some members' minds.
That is really, really interesting. Proactive moves. So after the House voted yesterday, the president met with Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi and some other lawmakers, and it kind of went sideways, right?
It did. Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, and Steny Hoyer, the number two leader in the House, said they walked out of the meeting with the president about Turkey and Syria after the president called Pelosi a third-rate politician. Pelosi said Trump was having a meltdown because he was upset that so many Republicans voted for that resolution against his decision to withdraw from Syria. Then later, Trump tweeted that it was Pelosi who had a meltdown and that there was something wrong with her, quote, upstairs.
Okay. And so I guess one big looming question is, will any of this have any effect on the impeachment inquiry?
I think these are really two distinct things. Foreign policy is an area where Republicans feel free to criticize the president. This is not something that the president's base is focused on. Most of Trump's base doesn't really care about the Kurds or know who the Kurds are, maybe. And I think that they have been in lockstep with him on the impeachment battle. And it's possible that some of the aggressive pushback on Syria is a proxy for their frustration with Trump on other issues where they can't speak out. But right now, I think these two things are pretty distinct.
NPR's Mara Liasson. And Mara, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, this morning, House investigators are expecting to hear from one of the three amigos.
Gordon Sondland was among Ukraine advisors for the White House, along with Energy Secretary Rick Perry and former Ukraine envoy Kurt Volker. They were known as the three amigos of policy on Ukraine. Sondland is now a witness in President Trump's impeachment inquiry in the House. He is the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, and for years he was an influential presence in his home state of Oregon.
Jeff Mapes is a senior political reporter with Oregon Public Broadcasting. He's followed Sondland's career. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, good to be with you, Noelle.
So who is Gordon Sondland?
Well, he's a very wealthy businessman. He splits his time between Portland and Seattle, basically made his fortune in the hotel industry. Yes, we do have rich alpha males in Portland. He has some common interest with the presidents there. His parents escaped Nazi Germany, and I think that's part of what sparked his interest in being an ambassador to Europe. He's also very definitely in political influence. You know, in Oregon, he works with the Democrats who control most of the offices, but he backs Republicans at the national level. Also has been very close to the Bush family. And in fact, when Jeb Bush flamed out in the 2016 presidential primary, you might have thought that was it for his ambassadorial dreams. But when Trump became president, Sondland donated $1 million to his inaugural fund. And, that seemed to do the trick. Last year, Trump sent him to EU headquarters in Brussels.
So I want to ask you about his reputation in Portland's political circles, because you mentioned despite its Portlandia reputation, there are rich alpha males there. What is his reputation? Do people like this guy? Do they trust him?
Well, you know, it's funny, when Sondland's name first came up from, you know, that now famous whistleblower's complaint, a lot of people here were saying, you know, probably know this guy from the hotel fight. And that was a reference to his long but unsuccessful fight to stop the construction of a publicly subsidized hotel at Portland's big convention center. He lost that fight, although he did get some financial concessions. I mean, I think the point of this is he can be a very determined guy, and he is known for, being very active in charitable causes, but for also being very forceful for, nonprofits he serves on, and certainly in his business affairs.
So really a known quantity there. I know that you've been talking to some of Sondland's friends in Oregon, and you've been asking them what advice are they giving him prior to this testimony. What did they tell you?
Yeah, I talked with investor David Nirenberg, who had worked with Sondland on fundraising for Republican causes. Now, I should say that Nirenberg is no fan of Trump. He did tell me that he sent an email to Sondland urging him to be as upfront as possible.
If there's anything that with the 2020 hindsight that you said or did that you regret, then just tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and put it behind you, and never forget that what got the Watergate people in trouble was not so much the break-in, it was the concealment and the lying. So,
Yeah, I mean, it's very clear House investigators think that he's somebody who knows what the president said and what he was asking for. He seems to be somebody, you know, who's really just talked to all the players.
Jeff Mapes with Oregon Public Broadcasting, thanks so much.
Hey, you're welcome.
The United Kingdom and the European Union say they have agreed to a Brexit withdrawal deal. NPR's Frank Langfitt is on the line from London. Hey, Frank.
Hey, good morning, Noelle.
So it has been a journey.
It has.
What's in this deal? What's in this deal? And how does it address the really big hurdle, which was all along the Irish border?
Well, it looks at the moment as though the EU and the UK have managed to square this circle. And the way the deal works is it actually will avoid the creation of customs posts along the border between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic. And that's really crucial because that would have been a disaster, frankly.
Yeah.
If they'd had to have customs posts, there was a fear of a return of violence from the days of the Troubles. And the way they're going to do this is very creative, and really it is sort of the art of the possible in politics. Northern Ireland, if you stay with me on this, is going to technically stay in the UK customs territory. But let's say products go from Great Britain, which is, of course, England, Wales, and Scotland, across the water into Northern Ireland, and they might then end up in Ireland, which will be, of course, is still part of the EU, then the United Kingdom would actually collect tariffs on behalf of the EU.
Okay.
It's a way of, you know, kind of fudging this to some degree, but to avoid something much worse. The other big part of the element of this is that Northern Ireland, the elected representatives in Northern Ireland, because this is such an unorthodox deal, and they want to make sure that the people of Northern Ireland agree to this, a number of years in the future, they would be able to vote on whether they want to keep this very unusual arrangement.
Oh, so they will get to pick at a certain point.
Yes.
Oh, that's really interesting.
And so the thing, the concern was, I think it's a legitimate concern, is to say, listen, you're going to stay in this really weird relationship. But of course, you're part of the United Kingdom, but you're still more, you're closely aligned with the European Union in some ways. And how do the people of Northern Ireland feel about that? They will have a chance through their elected officials to decide on whether they want to keep this thing going.
So is Brexit a done deal now? Can we say that?
No. Brexit is never a done deal. This is going to go on for years. But the real problem now is domestic British politics for Boris Johnson, the prime minister. The Democratic Unionist Party of Northern Ireland does not like this deal. It is afraid that it may not be able to impose its will, because it's, if it wants to pull out of this deal, it may not have the political firepower, so to speak, to get out of this deal in the years ahead. And so it is actually right now withholding its 10 votes in Parliament on this deal. And the vote is expected in Saturday, if the EU, as we expect, in the next couple of days, ratifies this. And Boris Johnson doesn't have a majority in Parliament, so he could find himself being very successful in Brussels and coming back home and actually being defeated on Saturday by his own Parliament.
Oh, that is really, really interesting. It isn't over.
No.
So let me ask you something. If we were to identify a winner in these long negotiations, who would it be?
I think the EU. I think all along from day one, they had the leverage and the power. And Boris Johnson has actually had to make a lot of concessions here and even accept things that his predecessor, Theresa May, said she would never accept. But Boris Johnson has an election coming up and he wants to deliver. So he promised to do so. And that's what he says he's doing.
NPR's Frank Langford. Frank, thanks so much.
Happy to do it, Noel.
And there's news this morning that Congressman Elijah Cummings has died. His office released a statement saying he died from complications of longtime health challenges. Cummings chaired the House Oversight and Reform Committee, and he was a key figure in the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. Here's Cummings speaking after President Trump made critical remarks about his home city of Baltimore.
We must also stop the hateful, incendiary comments. We got to do it. Those in highest levels of the government must stop invoking fear, using racist language, and encouraging reprehensible behavior. It only creates more division among us and severely limits our ability to work together for the common good. As a country, we finally must say that enough is enough. That we are done with the hateful rhetoric, that we are done with the mass shootings, that we are done with the white supremacist domestic terrorists who are terrorizing our country and fighting against everything America stands for.
Cummings had not taken part in a roll call vote since September. The Maryland congressman was 68 years old. We'll have more on the legacy of Congressman Cummings on NPR today. And that is Up First for Thursday, October 17th. I'm Noel King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Join us tomorrow and follow us on Twitter at Up First for your daily roundup of the most important stories of the day.
And if you want more news from NPR, there is a radio show for that. You can find NPR's Morning Edition on your NPR station. You can find your station by going to stations.npr.org. And if you prefer podcasts and local news and latest headlines, you can take NPR everywhere with the NPR One app, which is findable in the App Store.
Maddie Sofia here, host of a new daily science podcast from NPR called Shortwave. We'll bring you new discoveries, everyday mysteries, and this week, Randall Monroe, professional nerd and creator of XKCD, explains how to use science to tell if you're a 90s kid. Listen and subscribe to Shortwave from NPR.